Hello, everyone. Welcome to the CLUIN webinar, Use of Geostatistical 3D Data Visualization and Analysis in Superfund Remedial Action Investigation, sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. I'm Mike Adam from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and I will moderate today's seminar. Before I introduce our speakers for today's seminar, there are a few logistics that I need to go over. And you can move to slide two to see some of these housekeeping things. If you're using a phone line, please mute your phone, but do not put us on hold. Sometimes there's some music that can come on when you put us on hold, and that interrupts our presentation. If you do not have a mute button, you can use star six to mute. During the Q&A session, those of you on the phone can take your phone off mute to comment and ask questions. At that time, I will direct you to hit pound six to unmute. Participants can type in questions using the question mark icon at the top of the HTML presentation. We will be holding the Q&A session at the end of today's presentation, but you do not need to wait until the Q&A sessions to submit questions via the text form. You may also use this form to alert us of any technical problems you may be having. The presenter will alert you which slide you are on. You will have to manually advance each slide. If you're using the HTML online version, you can navigate the presentation using the arrow buttons at the top of the screen as shown on slide two. At this time, you should have already clicked the Go to Session button at the top of the seminar homepage. After the session, you can access the feedback form and the additional resources links from the sidebar buttons on the seminar homepage. We've also conveniently provided a link to these on the last slide of the presentation. We appreciate your feedback and ask that you please fill out the form. If you wish to receive a printout receipt of the attendance, you can print the confirmation form that is displayed after you have filled out the feedback form. This event is being recorded and will be archived on the CLUIN website. You should be able to get it in about 1 to 2 weeks, probably closer to 2 weeks. And you'll be able to download it in several formats or replay it online. You may also subscribe to our CLUIN podcast to receive new archive seminars as they become available. And you can subscribe to all our RSS feeds by navigating to the news feeds page by going to the CLUIN homepage, clicking on the RSS news feeds button on the Staying Connected right-hand sidebar. In today's presentation, we will discuss how visualization and analysis methods can be used to support projects at various stages in a project lifecycle, and what to consider when scoping and procuring services, and what to plan for in terms of cost and schedule, and how to confirm and quality check the results. More of this is listed in the abstract on the webinar homepage. And now it's time for me to introduce today's speakers. Steve Diamond. He's a chemist with more than 15 years experience, including time at an analytical laboratory, in environmental consulting, and as a technology advocate at the US EPA since 2005. At the EPA, his focus is on acceptance and use of emerging analytical technologies and sampling strategies. Examples include real-time analytics, collaborative data sets, adaptive QC programs, and other successful strategies. He has a degree in environmental science and toxicology from UMass at Amherst. Kira Lynch is an environmental scientist with more than 20 years' experience in environmental characterization and remediation. Currently at the EPA, she is the Superfund and Technology Liaison for the Office of Research and Development in EPA's Region 10 Seattle location. She is a member of EPA's Engineering Forum and has served in a number of roles for the U.S. EPA and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in her career. And she serves on numerous evaluation and review boards for research projects in environmental remediation. She has a degree in environmental toxicology from California Davis and a master's degree in environmental engineering from the University, I might have messed that up, but from the University of San Francisco. Last and not least, Dr. Jackie Burton has 30 years' experience in environmental and natural resources investigations in both the public and private sectors, including positions at Exxon and Argonne National Laboratory. She is currently president of Sundance Environmental and Energy Specialists. She has directed over 150 site characterization, feasibility, and remedial design projects all over the world, and she specializes in the development and application of 3D geostatistical data analysis and visualization. You could even read more about our today's speakers from the bios on the seminar homepage. And once again, please make sure you have muted your phone. You may use *6 to mute your phone if it does not have a mute button. And so with all of that, I will now turn it over to today's speakers. Go ahead, Steve.
Thanks, Mike. Mike, do you advance the slides on your end?
What?
Do you advance the slides on your end? I'm just curious.
I do not.
Okay. Because I'm trying to do it through the website, and it's not going past the first.
It's not? Let me, sorry, I thought you were...
I can do it manually by clicking on the left, so that's fine. Okay, well, good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are. I'm Steve Diamond with the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology Innovation. Mike has introduced our speakers. We have a great lineup of speakers. Kira Lynch, who was the remedial project manager for the site we'll be discussing, Well 12A in Region 10, and Dr. Jackie Burton, who has been instrumental in putting together a lot of the 3D visualization work. So if you're following along with your slides, we're just on the intro slide, slide 3. And today we're discussing the use of geostatistical 3D data visualization analysis in Superfund remedial actions. Let's jump now to slide 4. And this is just a quick overview of what we'll be discussing in the seminar today. I'd like to spend the first 15 minutes or so sort of making the case for 3D visualization, why we use 3D visualization analysis, particularly in the Superfund remedial action activities. We'll introduce you to the case study, Time Oil Well 12A Superfund site in Tacoma, Washington. And then we'll talk about the use of 3D visualization and analysis to help identify data gaps, controls on remediation, and ultimately optimize the remedy implementation. We'll also provide some information on best management practices and additional resources. I guess to start off, we should note that my hope in putting together this seminar initially was to be able to show 3D visualization in a movie format. We'll talk about the software that we're using, but I was hoping to be able to share little mini movies that allow the user to zoom in and out, rotate, and that sort of thing. Unfortunately, the Clue-In platform as it stands right now does not provide us that opportunity to present live video to you through Clue-In. But we're hoping in the next year to be able to essentially redo the seminar and actually be able to walk you through the 3D visualization. So unfortunately, what you'll see today are just still photos on the slides, and these photos are taken directly from the 3D visualizations, but it does limit the wow factor, if you will, of what we can show you in terms of 3D visualization. So we really hope that as the capacity for Clue-In increases, that we'll be able to present live video to larger audiences, upwards of many hundreds of people, to be able to once again talk about the work that we're doing in 3D visualization within the Superfund program and specific to the Well 12A Superfund site. So keep your eyes out on the Clue-In calendar, and we will try to revisit this site and hopefully have some much more artful interpretations of the data and visualizations that you'll be able to watch in real time. Let's move now to slide 5. So I wanted to spend a few minutes, as I mentioned, sort of making the case for 3D visualization and why now, why 3D, why now? Well, certainly there has been a rapid acceleration of the benefit and utility of visualization software, and particularly in the environmental industry. Many of the software that we're using these days in the environmental industry have roots in other industries, oil and gas, mining, where Uncertainty related to where a particular ore is, for example, can have significant impacts on a project cost and thus the viability of a mining project or an oil and gas project, for example. And we're finding that 3D visualization really provides the same level of uncertainty management and our ability to use conceptual site models in the environmental remediation world as well. So we're looking at taking what has traditionally been our conceptual site models, which we are trying to move beyond conceptual, the conceptual component of conceptual site models and move more towards a life cycle concept of conceptual site models and quantitative to the point where we can make some decisions on these models. And that's really where we're going. So we're integrating geo-referenced data sets, multiple independent data sets for things like geology, hydrogeology, and analytical, so certainly our chemistry as well. And, of course, 3D visualization provides us a number of advantages, the first being limiting interpretation bias. So we're taking multiple independent data sets and putting them in a visualization platform to interpret data that we already have, but it's not incorporating interpretations of that data from previous reports. So, for instance, if you were to look at cross-sections or a conceptual site model as described in text, that comes with a certain amount of interpretation. And what we're trying to do is remove that on the front end and then use the 3D visualization as a way to assess data gaps and determine a path forward that seems most appropriate for the site. There's also a renewed emphasis and some new focus areas within EPA. And one of the big ones that I'm working on these days is high-quality, high-resolution site characterization. In fact, we are developing a course attributed to high-resolution site characterization. So keep your eyes out on the Kulin platform as well for deliveries of our new course on high-resolution site characterization. And it's particularly important not only in the Superfund world in terms of records of decision and getting through our remedial investigations and feasibility studies, but high-resolution site characterization really comes into play in support of remedy implementation, remedy selection, design, and optimization. And that's where we're going to be spending the majority of our time today with the Well 12A case study. There's also a focus on more meaningful and effective community engagement within EPA. And so we're trying to, across several platforms, use the types of visualizations that you'll see here today to try to communicate with the public, communicate with non-technical stakeholders, and also use as a technical tool for the technical teams to make interpretation and use of existing data. Let's move now to slide 6. Okay, so within the Superfund program, we face some significant challenges in terms of the cost of remediation versus the cost of characterization. And in our experience, remediation can be an order of magnitude or more than other pipeline costs like characterization. So remediation can tend to be expensive. And we think that 3D visualization is an important component of that in any stage of the Superfund pipeline. But in particular, as we move into remediation, where we're trying to understand the interaction of geology, hydrogeology, and chemistry, and the effectiveness of the remedies that we are implementing at these sites. Of course, we'll be talking about Well 12A today, which has a number of remedy components, so stay tuned for that. There's also a series of challenges that we typically face in cleanup, and things like volatile organic compounds, particularly those that act as DNAPLs. Reaching MCLs, maximum contaminant levels, can be a real challenge for us as a program. So we're left with sort of a couple of different types of sites if we were to plug a lot of our sites into categories. And they are small plume footprints. And a small plume footprint, we can often overwhelm the matrix, as you will, with intensive treatment. So things like pump and treat and more aggressive technologies, thermal, in-situ thermal, in small footprints can really do a good job to either destroy or render contaminants less toxic. Unfortunately, what we're left with more often than not are large plume footprints, where intensive treatment over the entire footprint is probably not cost-effective. So that leaves us with a number of strategies that we can try to employ to address these larger plume footprint sites. And there are things like the use of active treatment zones and areas of clean water flushing, the use of combined remedies, so combining several technologies to address the site, and we'll be talking about that today. But all of these things like target the actual target compounds, the age of the release, and the aquifer matrix structure are critical determinants as to how well we can achieve our remedial action objectives, whether or not we can reach MCLs, for example, in groundwater. So that's where we're going to be spending our time today, is talking about the age of the release and the complexities associated with the aquifer matrix that we really need to understand to improve our conceptual site models and ultimately our remedy effectiveness. Let's move to slide number 7. We face a number of challenges associated with our cleanup sites, and in my experience, they're most often attributable to what I call competing conceptual site models. There's a great quote from Donald Rumsfeld back in 2002, at the time that they were searching for the weapons of mass destruction, but I think I use it a lot in the environmental context because I think it really does help us get our arms around some of the challenges that we face. So in 2002, Mr. Rumsfeld basically, in talking about the search for weapons of mass destruction, had the following quote. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things that we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. And it's a bit of a mouthful, and it kind of brings a chuckle when I talk about this, but it's those unknown unknowns that we're trying to manage, the unexpected things that we find, the source area that we didn't expect, the underground storage tank that we didn't expect to be there. All these things affect our ability to clean up sites. And so conceptual site models, and in particular 3D visualization, can really help us determine where these things are in space and as they relate to key geologic and hydrogeologic features. Now, we also run into things like changing project managers, contractors, and property owners, and that the interpretation of the data that goes along with that can be a real challenge. So 3D visualization is a way to, with time, track the progression of the conceptual site model. And, of course, the data type and density that we're used to in more traditional investigations are not always of the density and or spatial representativeness and temporal representativeness that we'd like them to be at. And so 3D visualization helps us determine where we have uncertainty in those data and how quickly and how simply we can fill those data gaps to meet our needs as it relates to remediating sites. Slide 8. So to give you an example of the type of contaminant matrix and temporal complexities that we face, I've got a little bit of a busy slide here, but on top there's a multi-component model of solute transport. And one of the biggest challenges we run into is with monitoring wells and whether or not the monitoring well data is representative of what you see in the formation. And I have some slides to caution you on that in just a bit. But what you see there in the red box is the mobile porosity. And that is typically at a site is what a monitoring well will see. But as we know through our efforts in remediation, there are a lot of other things going on. There's adsorbed mass, there's absorbed mass, and then there's an interplay between all of those things, which causes things like back diffusion when you remove things from the dissolve phase and create a gradient from the immobile porosity to go into the mobile porosity. So on the bottom left there, to give you an indication of typically what our data has said versus a lot of the types of sites we encounter, we have two block diagrams. And these two block diagrams are equal from the sense that they both have the same average hydraulic conductivity, the same mobile porosity, even the same groundwater transport velocity. But you see on the bottom block diagram much more heterogeneity. And in fact, the heterogeneity associated with that bottom block diagram would result in something on the order of a tenfold greater mass transfer. So that is mass that is typically in the dissolve phase that may be traveling in the high hydraulic conductivity zones. Think of it as your sands and gravels. And that gets into those low K zones, silts and clays. And then as we clean up or remediate the high flow zones, which are typically easier to get at, the result is a bleeding out or a mass transfer from the low hydraulic conductivity units back into the high hydraulic conductivity units, which is the type of thing that we see with back diffusion, rebound when we turn remedies off and such. And on the bottom right, you see sort of a spectrum of sites. So all of those things apply to our ability to cost effectively and efficiently meet our remediation goals. So mass transfer, transport velocity, the age of the release, and the source of the mass. And typically we end up more on the right side of that spectrum where we have older releases, larger source masses, and we're left with a finesse strategy. So we need to understand our subsurface, we need to understand our heterogeneity, our aquifer matrix at a much finer scale, because the remedies that we're applying tend to be more finesse in terms of pump and treats where we can pump from, or in situ technologies where we might inject various reagents and where those may go and how they may react in the subsurface. Let's go to slide 9. So there are also a second challenge, one that I refer to as social aspects can complicate technical problems. And that are things like stakeholder communication and community engagement, which is how can we convey technical information in a meaningful way to non-technical audiences. And 3D visualization is really a way that we've found a lot of success, both for technical teams discussing issues associated with remediation, but also conveying information to non-technical audiences. So typically what we've seen are 2D visualizations. Think of it as your typical cross-section or your plan view map. And that data is subject to significant spatial extrapolation in many cases, and certainly interpolation in most cases. So what we end up with is the same data set, but often differing conceptual site models in the minds of different team members as to the fate of contaminant transport and those sorts of things that really affect our ability to meet our remedial action goals. Typically, we have a large quantity of data, but we need to be careful about considering what our performance metrics might be for the remediation that we're considering, what the trigger points might be. In other words, when do we turn one technology off and turn to another? And how do we combine those remedies for the most efficient and effective way to meet our remedial action objectives? And 3D visualizations allow us the ability to integrate multiple data sets. So we're looking at geology, hydrogeology, and chemistry, and we're combining those in a single visualization, which is typically what we would be forced to try to get our arms around across many, many reports, tables, and some limited figures. So it's taking a lot of data and putting it into a format that we can get our arms around. Slide 10, please. So as an example of that, this, when we first began working on the Well 12A site, one of the first things we asked for was the conceptual site model, and this was a prominent figure in that conceptual site model. Now, I'm a very visual person, so I had trouble taking all of this information, which there's quite a bit of information here. So each one of these points is a point on the ground surface, and associated with those points is a well, a sampling point, a depth, the time the sample was collected, and then concentration of the various samples, in this case for TCE, trichloroethene, which is one of the major components at this site. Now, if we jump to the next slide 11, here you're looking at, on the left and the right, that same data set, but we've integrated that data set into a 3D visualization. And then we've integrated not only the chemistry information and the spatial information that you found on the previous map, but we're also integrating hydrogeology. So we're looking at groundwater elevations and flow regimes. And on the right, we're looking at geologic packages. So we're looking at the source area, the plume configuration, and how it relates to key geologic units. In this case, silts and clays on the right-hand side, you'll notice a large clay package in green, a smaller clay package in red, which are really driving the configuration of why we see the plume, where we see it, at what points it's diving through various geologic features, and ultimately how it ends up at the little blue dot you see on the photo, which is a representation of where the public well is. And we'll talk a lot more about this And as I mentioned at the top of the talk, I'm sorry that we can't zoom in on some of these models and some of these visualizations and spin them around and show you some of the things that we do for our stakeholder meetings, but we're limited with the technology we have for today's seminar. So my apologies for that. Slide 12, please. The third and last challenge I'd like to talk about is responsible party challenges, and this isn't specific to Well 12A, but certainly is something that in the Superfund program we struggle with, whether it's the presence of what I call inconvenient truths, where responsible parties, their core business is not cleaning up contaminated sites, so they are making decisions essentially from a business standpoint. So if the regulatory agencies are requesting a well or a single well or maybe a few wells, from a business case, that makes a lot of sense to provide that information and not necessarily go to the type of density that we would prefer to import into our conceptual site models and our 3D visualizations. Or on the other end of the spectrum, as we've seen on a few different sites, sometimes we run into the issue of can't see the forest because of the trees. And in this case, I recently received a remedial investigation report that was 11,000 pages. And so the regulators then have to sort through and select data, and it can really, things can be obscured, reality can be difficult to interpret based on reports of that size and data sets of that size. So we really like 3D visualization as a way to level the playing field, whether you're dealing with a somewhat limited data set, and 3D visualization can help you chase down data gaps, or whether you're dealing with very large or very complex data sets that are difficult without some sort of visualization package to really get your arms on what's happening. And then the last example, unfortunately, the stakeholders don't always like what data reconstructions and 3D visualization do to their conceptual site models. I've been on a number of sites where we did 3D visualization, and the plume configurations changed dramatically based on a single well. And when we found that well was not screened in the right location vertically and was being used to project a 2D image of the plume to the surface, and we took that well out, it dramatically changed both the configuration of the plume and the potential source areas. And that can be a real challenge in the case of a stakeholder who impacted individuals who had what looked like two plumes emanating from two distinct properties to a single plume, and now they have one responsible party. So although they don't always like it, 3D visualization is a way to get at, particularly as we move to remediation, of what reality is at the site, and projecting 2D plumes down through the Earth's surface is problematic in the Z or in the vertical direction. And when it comes to remediation, we really need to understand that. So as an example of this, let's move to slide 13. I have some data here provided by consultant Stone Environmental. They do what's called the Waterloo, they use a Waterloo profiler. And the point I wanted to make with this slide is, and this is real data, is what you're looking at on the left in each one of those red dots is a discrete value for PCE collected from a profiling tool. And when they dropped a well screen across what was the highest concentrations, that well screen and the sample collected for PCE from that well screen was on the order of about 1,200 micrograms per liter. But as you can see through the discrete samples across that same area, several orders of magnitude, upwards across the whole data set, of 6 orders of magnitude difference in concentration. Now, from the perspective of perhaps monitoring a plume, that monitoring well, 1,200 micrograms per liter for PCE may be sufficient. However, if you're trying to design a remediation system for that, and you're using a passive reactive barrier or something of that nature, those things are based on resonance time. And if you've got concentrations coming through at 60 and 70,000 micrograms per liter, versus some of the results that we see on the top and bottom of that same graph at, you know, 10 or 20 micrograms per liter, that's going to significantly change your actual remediation design. So this is what's going on in the subsurface at most of the sites we see. And the reason for that is illustrated by the hydraulic conductivity example on the right. So what you're seeing in that actual well on the left picture is a combination of high concentration, low flow zones meeting with low concentration, high K zones, and you ultimately end up with a mixing of the two and a concentration that, while indicative of the average concentration across that well screen, may not provide the level of specificity to design a remediation system. Slide 14. So there's a couple of different types of software for environmental data visualization analysis. And most people, we're going to be focusing our time on the second bullet there, the 3D and 4D visualization softwares. And in particular, we'll be talking about our use at Well 12A of EVS and MVS, Earth Visualization Software, Mining Visualization Software, which is the package we use to address this site. But most people are familiar with things like Google Earth and ArcGIS, which provide great views from a two-dimensional perspective. Whether you're trying to look at cross-sections or whether you're trying to look at map view, they can provide useful information and great spatial information for things like looking at data distributions and details of some of the different data sets. But they don't allow an analysis of data with depth or elevation changes, which is really where the action happens when we start to talk about remediation. The nice thing about these tools is they're typically a prerequisite for running most of the 3D visualization programs, whether you're using EarthVision, EVS, MVS, GMS, RockWorks, or others. If you've already have that GIS-based system, then you have most of the spatial information for all of the well locations that you would need. And the only challenge for us at a lot of these sites is to then go back and try to get that third dimension, the Z dimension, to figure out where a sample was collected with depth, or where it may have been collected within a certain screen interval. The 3D and 4D visualization allow us to integrate all these different multiple independent data sets. So we're looking at, you know, hydrogeology, we're looking at bedrock, we're looking at saturated and vadozone distributions. And we can look at them in terms of 3D of space, and we can also look at them in terms of 4D, which is looking at things and holding a particular contaminant of concern constant, but varying what it looked like with time, which can really provide us a lot of information as we try to determine the effectiveness of our remedies and as we look to optimize remedies moving forward. Slide 15, please. So in this, as we move to the next section of the webcast now, I think I've set the stage a little bit for why we think 3D visualization and in particular conceptual site models are so important. I wanted to just take a minute to point out the fact that recently my office has been promoting more of a life cycle approach to the use of a conceptual site model. In the early days of the Superfund program, when computing power and software was very limited, conceptual site models focused on that first picture you see on the right, in the upper right, which is the pathway receptor networks. Now, these diagrams are critical components of any conceptual site model, helping project teams understand pathways for contaminant transport and potential human health or ecological exposures. But as a standalone conceptual site model, do not convey the spatial information, temporal, physical, chemical, and hydrogeologic information that can vary so significantly and affect our ability to both characterize and remediate sites. So by taking a more holistic view of the conceptual site model and using newer 3D visualization platforms, I like to think that our conceptual site models have become decreasingly conceptual and increasingly quantitative in nature, particularly as a site matures and more data comes into the system. So in the case of Well 12A, where we're looking at a site that's been around for some 20 years, we've got a significant data set. And the challenge for us is to integrate that data and get into something that we can delineate specific areas that may require additional action and understand how those areas relate both spatially and temporally to key hydrogeologic features that are often controlling our fate and transport. I'll just make note, too, of this conceptual site model life cycle concept. Keep an eye out on CLUIN for a publication which we just published this week, which talks about the conceptual site model life cycle. And if we move to the next slide, slide 16, this slide depicts one of the figures that comes from that new conceptual site model life cycle document. So it's the what we've done is taken a conceptual site model that and at least in the Superfund program, has been used often up through the RI phase and certainly to get to what we call a record of decision. But what we're advocating is actually using the CSM well beyond that and continuing to update the conceptual site model from its preliminary stages to a baseline through the characterization efforts and then really taking use and taking hold of that conceptual site model and using it in both the design and remediation stages. And also as a, it can be used in the post-remedy stage to document things like attainment of remedial action objectives or where things like institutional controls or engineering controls may be required. There's a lot of information that goes into a conceptual site model that has significant value both during and after the remediation. So what we've done here is attempt to list out the typical steps in environmental cleanup programs and then list the components of the conceptual site model lifecycle where typically along these steps we find significant data being collected, and then that data needs to get into some sort of conceptual site model to be evaluated, interpreted, and then used in the decision-making plan. So these are not programmatic requirements per se. What these are based on is best practices that we found in the Superfund program have really helped us get increase the utility of our conceptual site models and increase the utility or our ability to meet remedial action objectives. So those other programs you see, if you're working in those programs, we would encourage you to talk with your regulators and talk with folks in those programs to see if use of a conceptual site model lifecycle makes sense for your project. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Kira Lynch, and Kira will introduce the Well 12A Time Oil site to us and give us a little bit of background and history on that property.
Thanks, Steve. So going on to slide number 17, I'm going to give you some background on the site that we're going to use as our case example to explain how we've used the 3D visualization, the MBS, to help us with our remedy decisions. And this is the Time Oil site, and it is a large chlorinated solvent dissolved phase plume as well as a source area. So on this slide, you'll see we've got a source area, and then we have Well 12A, which is a municipal supply well that has been impacted by the contamination coming from that source area. It's the, we've got a, the dissolved phase plume is about a half mile long. So going on to slide number 18, this is a site that the primary contaminant of concern is TCE, but we also have PCE, DCE, and PCA. The site was first discovered by identifying the contamination in the municipal well. So the site was actually listed before EPA knew anything about where the contamination was actually coming from. And then after the site was listed, EPA had determined that the contamination in Well 12A was coming from the Time Oil property. So the first action that was taken on the site was actually to put air strippers on the municipal supply well to protect that municipal supply well. So going on to slide number 19, the facility was historically used for oil recycling and paint manufacturing. So we have a number of waste products at the site as well as the contamination from DNAPL at the site. We also had like a filter cake material, which was the waste material from the recycling of the oil that was basically just deposited on site. So it was used from 1923 to 1991 when the Time Oil Company left the property. So the property is currently used by a facility that's using it basically as a storage facility. So going on to slide number 20, this, like many of our sites, the site has a long history. The original ROD was signed in 1983. There was a ROD amendment done in 85. That was when they first discovered where the actual source was. So the 83 ROD just called for protection of the Well 12A wellhead through air stripping. The two ROD amendments that were done were basically to specify some actions that would be taken in the source area itself. The site had also been through several five-year reviews. Within those five-year reviews, one of the things that stuck out is that there was a continued concern as to whether the site had, we had done sufficient source remediation of the site, and it was clear that we still were having a dissolved phase plume that was impacting the well 12A wellhead. So the site has had a lot of action done, and we do have a groundwater pump and treat system that's been operating at the actual source area since October 2005. So going on to slide number 21, one of the problems that we had with the groundwater extraction system is, although it was running, it was not running at its design capacity, and it was clear that also that groundwater extraction system was not containing the actual source area itself. We also knew that we had a significant amount of DNAPL and LNAPL, and based on the information that we had collected on the site, we knew that even after all the actions that had been taken there, that we still did have LNAPL and DNAPL remaining on site, and that we were continuing to see an impact at the time oil, from the time oil site at well 12A. One of the other things, when you have an active operating municipal well field that I think impacts many of our sites, similar to this one, is that when we met with the city of Tacoma, one of the things that they indicated was that in addition to the current pumping strategy that they had for the well field, that their desire was to increase that pumping capacity by double in the next 10 years. And the pumping of that municipal well field was definitely impacting the migration of that dissolved phase plume, which put even more emphasis on the need to really look at the source area and whether we had sufficiently reduced that source strength so that as the city of Tacoma increased their pumping rates on their municipal well field, they weren't going to be continuing to pull more and more contamination deeper into their municipal well field supply. So going on to slide number 22, this is just kind of a cartoon schematic that we put together when I first started working on the site in 2008 and doing the five-year review to kind of communicate to management and all the stakeholders kind of where we were on the site. So when the source area was first identified, we knew that we had kind of this filter cake material, which is depicted by the red area on this figure. We also knew that we had lots of datostone contamination, and that we had surface soil contamination, as well as some DNAPL and LNAPL at the site. So going on to slide number 23, this just outlines all the actions that have been taken at the site, and I think this is very similar to many sites. One of the things when I took over the project that was kind of management's perception on the project was that, you know, look, we've done all this work already on the source area. We've got a groundwater extraction system in place. We have a vapor extraction system that was put in place that had removed over 54,000 pounds of VOCs. We had also done quite a bit of excavation of the filter cake and the contaminated soil. So going on to slide number 24, this depicts kind of the conceptual site model after all those actions were taken. You can see that the contaminated soil that was to the left of the time oil building was removed. We also know that we had cleaned up the datostone in the areas where we had put in the soil vapor extraction system. So you'll see here to the left of the time oil building where we no longer have kind of that datostone soil contamination depicted. That's where the boundaries of the soil vapor extraction system had been put. So when they put in soil vapor extraction, they didn't necessarily put it everywhere where we knew that we had a concern about vadostone soil contamination. So although the vapor extraction system had worked really well, it basically wasn't extensive enough to get at all of the areas where we knew we had vadostone contamination. We also know from the information that had been collected that we still did have a DNAPL and an LNAPL on site that basically nothing had been done about. And we knew that the groundwater extraction system in place was not containing the higher concentration dissolved phase contamination that was coming off of that DNAPL and LNAPL from the site. So going on to slide number 25, this just basically is a depiction when we first started working on the project, kind of looking at the historic information, kind of in a 2D picture of where we estimated the remaining filter cake to be on the site, as well as the estimated extent of the DNAPL is shown in orange, and the estimated extent of the LNAPL is shown in yellow. So this is just a way of communicating early on the project, which was the first step as an RPM, which was to sit down with the stakeholders and management and make a decision about where we needed to go on this site. The site, similar to many of the Superfund LEED projects, was a project where EPA was in conflict with the state. This site had been in LPRA for over 10 years, so it should have been turned over to the state, but the state was saying, okay, well, we're not going to take the site over because we feel that the remedy that was originally put in place is not complete and that additional action needs to be taken at the site. So these kind of initial figures and kind of the initial conceptual site model just needed to be sufficient enough to be able to get consensus of EPA management and the stakeholders that we needed to take another kind of holistic look at the site as to what our next steps should be. So going on to slide number 26, this is basically the desired end state that we got consensus with everyone as to where we needed to go with the remedial action associated with the source. And so the goal here was to be able to have an adequate source strength reduction so that that source would not be a long-term ongoing source to the dissolved phase plume and basically would allow the city of Tacoma to be able to have access to that groundwater aquifer without the concern of pulling that dissolved phase plume further into their municipal well field. We also wanted to have a timely transition to a cost-effective polishing step. So the goal of the state was really not to have a long-term groundwater pump and treat system to try to contain that source area into the future with no exit strategy identified. So they really wanted to reduce and eliminate the need for pump and treat for containment. And we also wanted to have appropriate reliance on that monitored natural attenuation. We do know that there is some attenuation that had been occurring in the actual source area itself, although that had kind of stalled out a number of years ago. So we wanted to be able to make sure that any kind of use of natural attenuation was really backed up technically. And then finally, we knew that we wanted to have an adaptive, flexible implementation. And this is a quote that I like, which is, the sources begin to reveal themselves as remediation progresses. And I think what we mean by that is that we knew that this is a classic example of a site where we could spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on characterization, but it is the type of site where we've got a lot of those unknown unknowns where until we start actually working on the source area itself, we may not have a full picture of the extent of contamination in the source area. And just as an example of that, as we've progressed with some of the remedial action on this site, we found out a number of things. Like, for example, as I went into characterization, we actually discovered a large underground storage tank with products still in it that that we have since just started excavating and removing that, and we've pumped out thousands of gallons of product from that tank. So there a knowledge that we had extensive contamination still in the betazone in certain areas of the site that hadn't been removed with the initial remedial action. So going on to slide number 27, this kind of just outlines what our path forward was after the 5-year review. So the first step was to really identify and transparently document remedial action objectives. One of the problems with this site is that the original ROD, similar to many RODs that were signed in the early 80s, really didn't have clear RAOs. Basically, if you went in and looked at the original ROD, it talked about the long-term goal being groundwater restoration, but then it had kind of some tiered goals of basically being able to show that we had cleaned up the source area. It talked about cleaning up the dissolved phase plume sufficiently so that we wouldn't have to continue to use the air stripper at well 12A. So it kind of had some tiered goals, but really nothing, no clear remedial action objective that could be linked to an operational and functional determination so that we had clear communication with the state as to when we would be considering that the actual source treatment component of the remedial action had met an ONF goal and could be turned over to the state. So we spent a lot of time on really clearly reevaluating the remedial action objectives and making sure that those were really clear, and documenting that in a ROD amendment. So prior to doing the ROD amendment, what we did leading up to that is we worked with Steve's office, and one of the first steps was to get years and years of historical data in a form that we could look at as a team and communicate on and make sure that we were all looking at the same conceptual site model. So we did that through entering all of this information originally into EVS. And identify and make sure that we were all using the same conceptual site model. And from that, identify what kind of data gaps we had that were impacting our particular decision at the time. So what you'll see as we move through this case example is that as we move through conducting the focus feasibility study to support the ROD amendment to remedial design, we had different uncertainties in the conceptual site model that revealed themselves as being uncertainties that we needed to resolve in order to make the decision for the particular point in time that we were at in the decision process. So all of this led up to a ROD amendment that basically documented the path forward for taking additional source actions at the site. So going on to slide number 28, I think I'm going to turn this over to Jackie now.
Okay, thanks, Kira. And in this portion of our presentation, what we're going to focus on is using the existing data to build an initial remedial mitigation CSM as described in the life cycle that Steve presented. And the first step in building any CSM with 3D visualization is to collate, evaluate, and systematize the physical and chemical data for the site. And if you look on the left side of this slide, number 28, you'll see, you see the data available for us for the 12A initial visualization in 2008. And you can see we had over 100 geologic logs, soil sampling data from three time periods for five contaminants, groundwater data from three periods for six contaminants, and groundwater level data for four different periods. And as you look on the right, you can see that all the data are now systematically documented in spreadsheets and log formats. And there are many best management practices to be followed in the documentation and formulation of the site data for geostatistical 3D visualization. And Steve will speak to several of these later in the webcast. An important thing is once these data sets and databases are completed for the existing site data, they serve not only as the source files for the 3D visualization, but they establish a baseline data system for future investigations and can be expanded to accept new data for continuing evolution of the CSM as we solve data gap issues and resolve uncertainties. And if you go now to slide 29, we'll begin looking at 3D visualization images representing the results of this initial CSM analysis for 12A. Now I'm going to use this slide to orient ourselves. We're looking at several of the slides that follow that summarize the 3D visualization results. If you look in the center of this blue rectangle, you'll see a high-resolution aerial photography. It's actually georeference photography. And we use this for the top of the visualization, and it also reflects the topography of the site. As we move forward in future slides, you'll see an undulating surface that this surface represents. If you look at the blue rectangle itself, and you look at the north arrow there on the left, you'll see that we're operating within a grid system in which the northern coordinates are given along the y-axis, the 600 numbers. Those are the northern. You come along on the bottom of the rectangle, you'll see the eastern coordinates in the 1000s. And then you'll see the elevation coordinate coming up along the intersection of the northern and eastern coordinates. Now, the grid represents a unique point in space, or a unique position in space. And if you look at the various groundwater, you'll see all these different colored spots on the aerial photography. Those represent groundwater data points. And they also occupy a unique point in space. In other words, there's a specific XYZ point, which is unique to them. And this means that the visualization we're building is an accurate spatial depiction of our data. It's not schematic, it's not a schematic block diagram or a subjective interpretation of that data. Now also keep in mind the position here is Time Oil, the little red building right here. Well 12A is the little blue dot. Concentration legends are given on each side for soil and groundwater. And the important thing, because some of the legends as we've enhanced the pictures aren't in view, to keep in mind for the ones slides I'm presenting, the ones Kira's presenting, when you see red, yellow, green, it's a higher concentration. The blue is the lower concentration for both soil and groundwater. Now the lithology varies from gravel to clay and silt. So when you see a geology depiction with green and red, we're in the low permeability units. And the yellow and gray are the more high permeability sand and gravels. One of the things that needs to be pointed out is why do we have the strange shape on this aerial photograph? Why isn't it a rectangle? Now, the shape delineates the spatial boundaries of, in this case, our geologic data set, which is the most extensive spatial data set we have. And this is called the convex hull. By keeping our geostatistical kriging within the convex hull, we are ensuring that we have only interpolation within known data boundaries. And each of our data sets that we saw in the previous slide, geology, water levels, groundwater samples as shown here, soil contaminant samples, are geostatistically created as separate visualizations and each have their own convex hulls. It's important to keep this in mind as we look at the 3D visualization images that are following, where groundwater contamination, soil contamination, water levels, and geologic units are all integrated into one picture. These data, the four data sets, are not interdependent, but rely on their own data sets and their own base or component visualizations. Therefore, when we end the 3D visualization process, we reach conclusions and site features using multiple lines of independent evidence, a very important concept. And one final note, lest I forget, some of the still images here are presented from different angles in the 3D visualization at different scales to present the specific findings. So if you look and you see the numbers appear backward, it's just because the visualization has been rotated to get the best view, and these axes then can appear to you in a backward format. So if we go to slide 30.
Hey, Jackie, I hate to interrupt you here. I'm going to interrupt and have people, please put your phone on mute. Hit *6 if you need to. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, and we're on slide 30. And as Kira described to you earlier, the 12A site had not been adequately characterized as to the extent of contamination and the fact that they had 3 remedial actions performed. Now, this slide begins to summarize the extent of groundwater contamination documented through the 3D visualization process. If you look at the yellow blob in the center, this is a depiction of the TCE plume at 12A at the 300 part per billion ISA level. The light blue lines show the water levels at 12A and the area of influence of the present groundwater extraction system. And one of the major questions to be addressed by the remedial design CSM was if the gas was containing the groundwater contaminant plumes at the site or how well, or did the contamination extend beyond these systems as well as the extent and location of those groundwater contaminant plumes. As you can see, the TCE plume is migrating outside of the gas influence area. 12A is shown as the blue dot, and with pumping of 12A, groundwater flow moves in the direction of 12A. Hence, the contaminant plume has the potential to migrate even when the gas is operational. And we built visualizations, 3D visualizations, for the groundwater contaminants at 12A. And the other groundwater contaminants were visualized at different ISA levels but were contained within this gas area of influence, but at levels well above the MCL. If we go to slide 31, this slide illustrates the 3D visualization results of integrating the soil contaminant visualization, the groundwater level visualization, and the groundwater contaminant visualization. Here is an example where you get the reverse number on the axis, so don't be confused by that. And it's a slightly different view. We're looking, here's Time Oil, and here's well 12A. 12A is at the right in the blue dot, Time Oil, the red building. And the near surface yellow next to the Time Oil building is near surface soil contamination found around and beneath the building. The lower yellow oval with the arrow pointing to it is soil contamination above 5,000 parts per billion found deeper in the system near the water table. Note the position of the high concentration deeper soil and the high concentration groundwater TCE plume. The visualization demonstrates that the deeper soils are actively sourcing the higher concentration groundwater plumes within the gas. So we have two different locations of soil contamination that will need to be addressed in the remedial design for 12A. Also note the flat surfaces of both the soil and groundwater contaminant plumes. And we will look at what may be causing this in the next slide, number 32. Now this image from the 3D visualization shows that for the CSM shows us why we have the flat bottoms to those contaminant plumes, as well as the migration pathway that exists from Time Oil for the TCE plume from Time Oil to well 12A. Once again, the red building is Time Oil, the blue dot is well 12A. The lighter green is the TCE groundwater plume at the 15 part per billion ISO level. And the yellow you see in the center of that green plume is the soil contamination at 5,000 parts per billion. Now three, and as Steve pointed out, part of the geologic package that's controlling things at Time Oil, at, for the plume and the soil, you see two extensive silt layers in darker green, and one becomes even darker green over here at the upper northwest side, as well as a clay layer. Now these are low permeability units that are controlling the downward migration of TCE, and hence you see those flat bottoms for soil and groundwater plumes beneath Time Oil. And keep in mind, the plume is constructed separately, so this was brought in and it explained why we have that flat bottom. In addition, we see we have a hole in this system as you come just to the southwest of on the pathway to well 12A. And this gives the plume the opportunity to dive down through that hole in the silt and migrate towards 12A itself. So the result of this is we have two high concentration soil areas and a high concentration groundwater that must be addressed in remedial design, as well as the geologic features that appear to control the distribution and morphology of this deeper soil source in yellow and the groundwater plume in light green. Slide 33, please. And we're going to go through now some of the key visualization analysis findings from this initial remediation mitigation CSM. Once again, we see the plume escaping the gas and demonstrates that the remedy in place is not controlling the TCE groundwater plume migration. As Kira's pointed out, it's migrated at concentrations greater than 500 parts per billion beyond the gas, and the position of the 300 part per billion isolevel plume is serving to establish a 300 part per billion flux line that Kira will address in the remedial actions being considered for the 12A site. In addition to TCE, the visualizations generated the morphology and spatial dimensions, as well as mass and volume for four other plumes, PCE, PCA, Trans-DCE, and Cis-DCE. that are all presently contained within the GATS area of influence, but once again, above MCL levels. If we go to slide 34 now, the remedy in place is not only controlling, is not only not controlling the migration of the TCE plume, the 3D visualizations do not support that it's controlling the source contamination that's feeding the plume shown in the slide. Visualization results indicate two distinct contamination areas that require remediation. If you see the little the yellow blob up by the yellow soil concentration, a zone up by and beneath the time oil building is separate from this deeper one soil concentration area near the water table interface. And five soil contaminants were visualized in the remediation mitigation CSM. So the result is now we have no guessing on where to target our treatment. And if we go to slide 35, this slide shows an enlarged view of sourcing at the plume at depth that better illustrates the intermingled source plume linkage. The active secondary source is shown in the yellow right here and the plume in the green. And we also know that there's a strong geological control, the silt and clays that are controlling the morphology and distribution of the deeper soil contamination and resulting plumes that have to be considered when we go into the select remedial selection and design. And in addition to these, to the 3D visualization findings, EPA and CDM identify the transition from anaerobic to aerobic conditions during the construction of the CSM that exist at approximately the position of the highest concentrations of groundwater plumes for all six contaminants. So now we know the position, dimensions, hosting units, mass and volume of the soil source feeding the plume for evaluating remedy modification to eliminate the source. Slide 36. This is also an enlarged view of the the contaminated source units, showing the one near surface as Kira described, the filter cake and near surface source contributions. And then also the plume, you can see the plume near the water table, and on it are the samples used to derive this plume. And this is something within the 3D visualization you should always expect and look for, is to put the actual samples on and make sure the plume is commensurate with the sample distribution. We can now add to our visualization analysis by layering confidence uncertainty on top of our soil potential source areas with existing sample to determine optimum location for increasing our confidence as needed for remedial design. In this way, we can continue to revolve the remediation mitigation CSM to higher levels of confidence in moving through the design process. Slide number 37. The last slide in this section on the remediation mitigation CSM initial visualization shows the identified initial boundaries for source treatment. The upper left figure is a plan view of the groundwater plume we looked at 300 parts per billion, and the initial treatment boundary in red for the high concentration plume. The bottom left is a plan view of the soil contamination we've been looking at to illustrate the lateral extent of the soil contamination for treatment. And the right image is an enlarged 3D view of the higher concentration groundwater plume at depth with initial treatment boundaries shown in red. And also note the position on the silt layer we looked at previously. So our initial remediation, mitigation, CSM, 3D visualization for the existing site data documented the extent of soil and groundwater contamination for 12A, the features controlling the migration retardation of the contamination, and location and boundaries for two soil treatment areas and one higher concentration groundwater pond. Now I'll turn the talk back to Kira to discuss how 3D visualization analysis is continuing to be used as they move through remedy optimization. Kira?
Thanks, Jackie. So one of the things that I wanted to point out, I think you'll notice that the logo on the visualizations changes from Sundance to CDM at this point, and CDM has done the majority of the visualization for us, but I think one of the things that I wanted to point out is that one of the benefits of using this type of tool is that you can pass information from one contractor to the other very easily without having to start all over and to have to develop a new whole conceptual site model. It's available to anyone, so if you have someone who knows how to use the software, you could basically can easily pass it from one contractor to another, which has been a problem on many of our sites where, you know, we have a new RPM or we go to a new phase of the evaluation and we have to move from one contractor to the next and then they're starting all over from scratch. So I think that's a definite real benefit of having the data housed in this type of system is to allow transfer and building of the conceptual site model as opposed to constantly having to start over. So once again, where we are in the process right now is this is just showing kind of the visualizations of the site going into the focus feasibility study. So what we needed to have as far as conceptual site model resolution at this point was really a clear understanding of what our goals were. And in this case, for the filter cake in the shallow soil, the goal was to eliminate the risk of direct contact with that filter cake at the near surface and to prevent or minimize the migration of contamination from that highly contaminated shallow source areas into the deeper vadose zone, which is kind of on this figure here is depicted as the area that's kind of boxed with red. It was mostly to the right-hand side of the building where they had not done any previous soil removal or any vapor extraction, but we knew from kind of the historical borings and other things that we expected that there was filter cake in that area as well as significant amounts of contaminated soil, as you can see, kind of depicted by the green area to the right of the building. In addition to that, we had set up our goals for the deep vadose zone soil, which was basically to eliminate and minimize the mass of contaminants that were getting into the dissolved phase plume. So going on to slide number 39, this basically is depicting the area of the high concentration groundwater plume that was being targeted for source treatment. And one of the things that Jackie pointed out that I think is key here is that whenever you go in to do source treatment, one of the questions that you'll have is, okay, where are we doing source treatment? How are we defining the boundaries? And what is the rationale for that? And in this particular case, we had a site that all of the dissolved phase plume up gradient of the 300 ppb kind of contour, at one point, as Jackie pointed out, had been an anaerobic area of the plume, had been going actively doing some biological degradation in the area, and we also see that the plume quickly kind of reduces in concentration down gradient of that and becomes more of a diffuse, lower concentration dissolved phase plume. So we defined our targeted source treatment area as all contamination kind of up gradient of that 300 ppb area. So the next step was, if that is our source area, what's our goal for that? What's our goal? Once we reach that goal, we could have agreement with the state that we can say that this site is, the remedy at the site would be operational and functional. And what we decided to use was to use a flux-based goal. And so we set a flux-based goal in the ROD amendment of a 90% flux reduction. And that was selected based on various factors. One was we looked at, we knew what we could achieve from an engineering perspective, realistically, with source treatment that had been designed properly and was targeting the full area where we knew we had residual source and potential LNAPL and DNAPL. In addition to that, we did some general modeling of the dissolved phase plume, and we determined what would be the source strength reduction that we needed to achieve in order for the natural attenuation capacity of that dissolved phase plume to sufficiently reduce that dissolved phase plume so that we could say that we would no longer have a migrating plume, so that we would eventually have a plume that would be reducing in size versus one that would be continually expanding into the future. So that was the goal that was set for the actual source area treatment itself. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is that these types of visualizations can be used to help us kind of understand the dynamics of the system and be able to set up realistic, achievable, measurable goals for source treatment, which we have a tendency not to have done a good job on, especially on some of these sites that were had rods that were signed in the early 80s time frame. So we also set up goals for the larger dissolved phase plume, which the initial goal associated with source treatment was to be able to reach the MCLs at points of compliance just down gradient of that source area, with a long-term goal of having complete plume restoration to MCLs. So going on to slide number 40. So this just basically depicts for you the uncertainty in the conceptual site model. And one of the steps as you go through this process, although we felt that the conceptual site model with the historic data was sufficient to be able to support a focused feasibility study, as we started to look at remedy design, we needed to look at what are some of our unknowns or uncertainties with that conceptual site model that could impact our decisions. So what you want to do is you want to go through and you want to lay out those uncertainties, and you especially want to identify uncertainties in the conceptual site model that, if you're wrong about it, is going to result in a significant impact on how that remedy is going to perform or what the cost of that remedy is going to be, anything that's going to have a significant impact on your decisions. You really want to look closely at those components of the conceptual site model to make a decision about how you're going to resolve those. Because basically, you can resolve uncertainties of the conceptual site model basically through just three actions. One would be to collect additional historic information that would help you resolve that uncertainty. Another way to control uncertainty moving into remedy design is to design around it, right? So you can, in some cases, an uncertainty with a conceptual site model can be managed through having a more conservative design that basically mitigates the impact of that uncertainty. And the third option is to collect additional information to basically be able to resolve or have more certainty in that component of the conceptual site model. So you can see here that one of the things that we had a concern about going into remedy design was the question about whether we had sufficient source material underneath the actual time oil building to require aggressive source treatment. So just to back up a little bit, I don't think I've outlined for you what the focus feasibility study, basically the outcome of that was. The outcome of the focus feasibility study was that we were going to target treatment in the source area with basically three tools. So one of them was to do additional excavation of the near surface soil contamination, the filter cake. The other component was to target areas of really high concentration DNAPL and source material with remediation. And the third piece was to apply enhanced bio to kind of the higher concentration dissolved phase plume. So the way that the rod is laid out, going back to kind of a comment that I made earlier about having an adaptive type approach, the rod doesn't specify the boundaries for how we apply each of those technologies. It just says that we're going to use them, and the idea is that we are going to move into remedy design and go through a stepwise fashion of applying the technologies and be able to have the flexibility to refine the boundaries, for example, of where we're doing the excavation versus where we're doing the in-situ thermal versus where we're doing the enhanced bio, so that we would have the flexibility as the conceptual site model evolved to kind of mix and match the technologies to optimize how we're using each of them. So going on to slide number 41, one of the things that we decided was just too big of an uncertainty was how much contamination we had under that building. And the reason for that is that if we were going to target trying to do in-situ thermal underneath the building, that the cost associated with the in-situ thermal was going to be significantly higher. So that was going to be a big uncertainty going into trying to procure a contractor to do that, that would impact the cost. So we decided that it was worth collecting additional characterization data prior to trying to put out the RFP for the in-situ thermal to, you know, clearly make a decision in our own minds as to whether the mass under the building was sufficient enough to require in-situ thermal under the building. We also had some previous geophysical anomalies in the area where we're going to excavate that we felt needed to be resolved, which since then ended up turning out to be that tank that I mentioned earlier that we found. We also had some questions about the total organic carbon content since that would impact the in-situ thermal design. So going on to slide number 42, this just depicts for you the conceptual site model and the NVF visualization coming out of that initial remedy characterization effort that we went through. And there's a couple of pieces of information that became really clear from that investigation. One was that we definitely had contamination under the building that needed to be targeted. But another piece of information on the conceptual model that came out of that investigation was the identification of this kind of a low permeability, very kind of thin silt layer that was binding up TCE at very high concentrations. So it's down at like 50 feet below ground surface, and it is only about a foot thick, but it's basically, it has absorbed the TCE at levels that was acting as a continual residual source area. So going on to slide number 43, this just shows you here kind of the area that was identified as the filter cake that needed to be excavated and the area underneath the building that was definitely at high enough concentrations that we needed to be able to target it with the in-situ thermal. Going on to slide number 44, this shows you the conceptual site model coming out of that initial investigation of the area where we knew that we had this kind of low permeability zone. And one of the things that came out of this is that basically this highlighted for our team another big uncertainty with the conceptual site model that was going to significantly impact design of that, of our source area remedial action. Much of this kind of low permeability zone was actually down gradient of the area where we were targeting for in-situ thermal. And it's basically kind of what we call a pancake. So it's a very thin layer of this low permeability zone down at like 50 feet below ground surface. And so it's not distributed in a fashion that really lends itself towards being able to target that with in-situ thermal, even though we have high residual concentrations. So we needed to not only understand better the extent of that low permeability zone and what the NAPL saturations were within it, but we also needed to kind of reevaluate within our source treatment suite of technologies how we were going to target that low permeability zone. So going on to slide number 45, this basically is a slide that just depicts kind of the uncertainty with the current visualization. You can see there, once again, like Jackie was saying, the red depicts areas of high uncertainty, the blue is low uncertainty. So what this pointed out to us is basically where we needed to do additional ongoing characterization. So we basically have mobilized for a second characterization effort, basically with two purposes. One was to basically better understand the extent and the magnitude of that low permeability zone. And then the other one, going on to slide number 46, was to basically understand the hydraulic gradients associated with kind of the dissolve phase, not only the concentration and the concentration in three dimensions within the dissolve phase plume, but also kind of the hydraulic gradients across that flux line. As Steve talked about earlier, we know that within the dissolve phase plume, we can have variability within the hydraulic gradients, and that variability is going to influence the contaminant flux through the plume across that depth interval. So we really needed to better understand kind of what the fluxes were in three dimensions in order to understand kind of what the significance was of the source that was hung up in this lower permeability zone, as well as better understand kind of how we were going to place our flux measurement zone to assess the performance of source treatment. So going on to slide number 47, this basically is just an outline here of the additional characterization. The borings that are depicted in yellow are the ones that we're dynamically putting in, and basically we're doing that investigation right now. So we don't have the update for the MBS completed yet with this additional data input, but that's what we're in the field doing right now. And I think it just, once again, it goes to highlight something that Steve said earlier, which is what this allows us to do is to have a tool that allows us to update the conceptual site model in real time as we're moving through remedial action. So not only are we doing the additional characterization, but we're also out in the field right now doing the actual excavation to the right of the time oil building. So the information that we're getting from the excavation as well as the additional characterization data is being input into the MDS, and it will be used as a key tool that will be associated with the request for proposals, for example, for the in-situ thermal as well as the bio, to communicate to those remedial action contractors kind of what our current conceptual site model is and how it has evolved over time. And it's allowed our team, as we go through remedy design and remedial action, to really identify those assumptions about the conceptual site model that we've made that really could have a significant input on how we're designing the remedial action itself. So going on to slide number 48, kind of what's next for the 12A site? As I said, we're starting in on the remedial action right now. It's going to include, we're doing the excavation first. After that's complete, we'll be doing the in-situ thermal remediation, followed by the enhanced aerobic degradation plan, so that we're starting on the treatability studies for the EAB right now to look at various types of kind of food sources for the plume, things that could maybe influence the availability of the TCE DNAPL that's hung up in that low permeability zone. And we will be, initially, the next step in the process will be to get our baseline flux measurements done so that we have a baseline of the flux to be able to compare against the post-treatment flux goal. So going on to slide number 49, I'm going to pass this back to Steve now.
Okay, thanks, Kara. My apologies again to the participants. I assure you that if we had the capabilities to zoom in and out of some of these visualizations and spin them around and point out certain aspects with real-time video, it would be a lot more impressive rather than trying to describe what you're seeing on your still slides. And as I mentioned at the top of the talk, we really hope to be able to do that within the next year because it really does make a big difference. We do this a lot with stakeholders and technical team meetings, and at any point we can, you know, pick out a particular well or a certain aspect of the geology and zoom in on it, focus in on it, change concentration, and so on and so forth. And it really does make an excellent troubleshooting tool, but it's a little more difficult for us to try to describe in a PowerPoint format with still photos that we're trying, or still pictures that we're trying to explain to you. So hopefully, at least from what you've seen here with the example of Well 12A, we've been able to convey both the utility of 3D visualization as well as the benefits of getting your data into these sorts of tools as a function of your conceptual site model. And so basically we've been doing this now on a number of Superfund sites. We're doing this in smaller brownfield sites and other type regulatory programs as well, and we find utility across those programs. So what we've done is compile a list of best practices for the use of 3D visualization analysis. And so I'll spend the remaining time that we have before we get into the question and answer session to try to point out some of those best practices for the use of these 3D visualization software programs. The first being is that we want to try to maximize use of existing data to produce what, if you were looking at the conceptual site model life cycle, would be the preliminary conceptual site model. Now, in the case of Well 12A, when we actually built the conceptual site model, and use 3D visualization to aid us in that effort, we were well into the remediation mitigation phase of the conceptual site model. But essentially what we're trying to do is use that to identify data gaps for further inquiry, and then in cases where it's appropriate, evaluate either our interim remedies or consider our final remedy performance and opportunities for optimization. So whether we're trying to use the conceptual site model to assess data gaps to actually get to either a project decision or a design, or whether we're using it in the later phases, it has tremendous value to track the progress of our remediation. In some cases, maximizing the use of existing data means that we have to consider temporal variations as well as changes in analytical tools, methodologies, and technologies. So when you're looking at a site like 12A, you're looking at 20 years of data, things change. Analytical methods change. Sampling technologies change. We have lots of sites where we've gone from 8260 VOC analysis to the use of passive diffusion bags and other things. And we have to consider how those data sets may or may not be comparable when we start to pop things into visualization and try to make some determination about how the plume morphology has changed with time, for example. So keep that in mind, as well as our understanding of things like our basic conceptual site models of behavior of different contaminants, whether it's an LNAPL, where traditional theory held that LNAPL sit on water, and a lot of our 3D visualizations of late show us with LNAPL components well below the water table, or our perhaps historical conceptual site model of how DNAPLs behave in the subsurface and whether or not they may cool up or whether or not they exist in discrete zones and ganglia and other types of things that can be particularly vexing or challenging to our remediation specialists. So we have to consider all those things when we look at data, and we look at data with time, and we do it in the 3D visualization program. But what it does allow us is the ability to look at the whole picture, that the integrated data visualizations, as Jackie mentioned, where we're bringing in multiple independent data sets, each within their own space and temporal, and when those things tell a similar story, you can think of them as multiple lines of evidence. It gives you a lot of power and a lot of confidence in your conceptual site model, thus, and in your ability to apply the remediation strategies that you've chosen for your particular site. Also, typically we build these with room to grow. So as Kira's site progresses here and they collect new data from these pre-design investigations that are happening, that data goes back into the conceptual site model and the 3D visualization and informs our next set of steps. So we're using them in as real time as we can. And with the power of the software and the computing power that we have today, there's lots of room for those things to really benefit our projects. In our experience, the biggest expense tends to be getting data into a usable format. And we have some spreadsheets and other software that allows us to take things from PDF and other boring logs and other things and get them into those. In the case of many of the projects, we're using just an Access relational database. So that can be a real challenge if the site that you're inheriting or the conceptual site model you're inheriting is all in hard copy format. But we have some best practices that we'll be coming out with, maybe a document in the next year, or certainly some outreach materials where we'll be talking about best practices for getting electronic data, managing data, and using that data in a 3D visualization format. But ultimately what we're after is hard data versus contractor interpretation, or anyone's interpretation for that matter. What we'd like to do is get that data into the visualization platform and then see where it takes us. Slide 50. So we put together a summary of best practices, and they really come down to about 8 steps. The first thing we like to do is identify the basic questions that we're trying to answer with the existing data. You can think of this as sort of like a data quality objective analysis where, you know, we can't design a sampling strategy or a remediation strategy if we don't know where we're trying to get to. So that's one of the first things that we do. And in the case of Well 12A, the fundamental questions that we had were, why is the remedy not reaching the goals? What is the time frame to potentially meet our remedial action objectives? Does the data indicate the identification of additional sources, which in the case of 12A and some of the stuff that Kira showed, we had both shallow source material in the form of filter cake, and we also had some deeper source material right at the vadose zone, saturated zone interface that was basically feeding the plume. That's the component that is a part of the component that's being addressed with the in-situ thermal. So understanding what those questions are really help us design what data we need. And then the second step is to identify the type of data that we're going to collect to answer those questions. And those typically fall into 3 categories for us: geologic information, hydrogeologic information, water levels and that sort of thing, and also our chemical information. What is our both our groundwater chemistry say and our sampling for our various contaminants. But it can include other things like unique site physical features, the existence of utility corridors or site basements, basement depths and that sort of thing. We've brought a lot of those things into visualizations as well. And if those are important, say from a vapor intrusion perspective or something of that nature, we like to try to collect that information and get it into our visualization. Step four, sort and documenting the hard data from interpretations. Jackie did a pretty good talk on that, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that one, although I do have one quick example on the next slide of some of the tools that we use to do it. And then we take that data and import it into a database format and build our visualization components from that. Once we get it into that database, we're really, in terms of usable data sets, we take an objective analysis of the data that we've got, and we use, whether it's a GIS or just a 3D data analysis, to evaluate the distributions that we have in a map format. And what we're after is the data sets that provide us the greatest distributions. So in the case of 12A, where we had 5 different contaminants, multiple sampling years, we can use older geology with newer chemistry, but we have to be very careful about making sure that the data sets we're using for chemistry are temporally constrained so that we're not mixing data sets over multiple year sampling events and that sort of thing. So that can be a real challenge for us and something that we focus on. And then, of course, once we've determined that we have adequate distribution of sampling information in map format, we want to do the same for our geology. And as I mentioned, we can use geology typically from across a wider temporal range than we can for our chemistry. But we want the largest and most adequate distribution of geologic information, wells, borings, CPT information, what have you. We've used them all and to get them into that. And I'll mention just a few more things on that in a minute. And then ultimately we're going to use that data in our 3D visualization. So let's jump to slide 51 as an example of what I was talking about in step 4, sorting and documenting the hard data from interpretations. This is one of the ways we do it. We create a simple matrix, and this is a really handy tool for us as it allows us to both open up what we've done for the visualization to other members of the team, interested parties, to see which data we've acquired, and specifically which data is being used to portray which visualizations. And so it gives us a history of the information that we've collected, the format that we've got it in, whether or not we had to do any sort of manipulation of the data. For example, if we had, sometimes we get well screen information or sample information, we don't know where within the well screen. We try to go back and collect that information, then we get that into the database as well. So this is basically a recreation of all the information that we've collected, what reports it came from, and how we used it to create our 3D visualizations. It's a nice little tool that we've used. Slide 52, in terms of step 6, sort of visualizing, if you will, your sample distributions. I have 2 examples here on the right from another site that we're doing some 3D visualization work at. And you see on the top there the data set from 1987 spatially was determined to be inadequate just due to the density. In this particular site, we're looking at a very large site, large plume, very deep. The entire site is something on the order of about 8 square miles. So when you have a data set that looks like the version that we had in 1987, it wasn't sufficient, the distribution wasn't sufficient for us to be able to perform visualization or any sort of geostatistical analyses. However, when you get to 2005, and after a lot more monitoring wells and some of the remediation systems have been put in place, we have a significant data set that we can start to view. So this is an example of there is no hard and fast rule for how many wells or how many data points are statistically or geostatistically valid to be able to do these visualizations. But really, the rule that we use is to try to go after the richest, densest data set we have and then walk back from there. So typically, we'll go after the heaviest, densest data set. That will become our chemistry data set. And then we'll use different depictions heading back with time from there. Slide 53. I just wanted to make one point about the geologic logs, and that is that when we try to get these into our geologic log database, there is usually a wide variability in the types of logs that you get. So if you're lucky, You may get something like the version on the left that's very well described, very easy to read, has a, you know, perhaps use the USGS soil classification system. Those sorts of things make for really nice logs. On the other hand, typically at a site you get a wide variety of logs. So you may see something like what you see on the right, handwritten. Maybe the person who logged the borehole was as descriptive as saying things like sand, same as above, 20 feet. So you're going to get a wide range of things, and the challenge for us to get it into 3D visualization is to basically develop a consistent lithologic classification scheme. So we can bring the most complex log down to the simplest log, but we can't bring the simplest log up to the most complex. So what we're often stuck with and when we try to develop the geologic components of these 3D visualizations is making determination of things in terms of like sand, silt, clay, or if we're lucky, we may classify them in terms of different indexes of relative hydraulic conductivity, which I'll talk about real briefly in a second. And the other point is just to make sure that you're using actual basement elevations versus depth normalized or other interpretations of basements. We've had examples where people determine bedrock surface based on refusal of direct push, and in a cobble environment that can be very challenging where you may get refusal but you're not actually at bedrock. Those types of things can really wreak havoc with your conceptual site model and ultimately your ability to adequately address these sites. Slide 54. The same goes for the use of actual data versus measured data. On the left you see a graph from a site that we're working on. The red is the predicted water levels for a particular well at the site, whereas the blue is the measured water levels. So we always want to use the measured water, the measured values. You notice a fair amount of fair difference in the groundwater elevations here between what the regional groundwater model had predicted versus the observed values. So we're after the observed values. And you also notice, too, here over a series of years, you have very wet and, along with the seasonal fluctuations, you have very wet and dry periods of, say, 5 to 6 years at this particular site, which can be really telling for how we might operate some of our remediation systems. So keep that in mind as well. Slide 55. I did want to pay some respect to my geologist friends here, and I put this slide on here. This is not Well 12A, but this is another site that we're working on that geology is a really important component of the conceptual site model because it is driving the entire plume morphology and therefore would be driving both the pumping strategy and other techniques to address this plume. So what you see on the left here is a plume and geology both depicted. The plumes are in purple. The geologic information in this case is both used in slices through the site. You'll notice the slice. You'll also notice this cooler colors, these blue and lighter blue colors, which are drawn from an index of relative hydraulic conductivity. So what we're after here is looking for primary transport channels where the plume has the path of least resistance. Because at this particular site, depending on what the groundwater levels are doing, the plume can go one of two ways and end up in two very different places in terms of its ultimate depth. So on the left there, you see a very shallow, tight primary transport channel there in blue that travels on one side of the hills and ends up with the resulting plume being relatively shallow. And there, if the conditions are not conducive for that contaminant transport pathway, they go around the hills, following that same primary flow path and getting significantly deeper on the backside, which as I mentioned, in the treatment area would significantly change the pumping strategy. Now on the right, something very similar, and on the bottom right you see the plume is depicted in red. And just notice the shape of the, in this case, PCE plume that we're looking at, and then take that same picture of the plume and go back up to the top picture on the right, which is the geology, depicted as an index of relative hydraulic conductivity, where you can think of the blues as high-flow gravels, and the warmer colors, the yellows and reds, as your silts and clays. So that's going to have a tremendous impact on how your plume is behaving. And indeed, when we depict both the geology and the plume, it comes back to geology matters, and geology matters significantly. So, you know, some may say this is a sign that the Mayans were perhaps right and that the world will end in 2012, but I prefer to think of it as my geologist friends are making a comeback, and that geology and hydrogeology are really driving our ability to meet remedial action objectives, and therefore at a lot of sites we need to understand geology and hydrogeology at an appropriate scale if we hope to be successful in our remediation activities. Slide 56. Another of our 3D depictions, as I was mentioning, from that same site where, again, we have the convergence of multiple independent data sets, all telling us or lines of evidence pointing to why we see the plume configuration that we do. So here we see the PCE plume in purple. We see the bedrock basement. We see the water levels for this particular time frame sitting on that bedrock basement, and then directly down gradient behind that bedrock high are low hydraulic conductivity units, tighter silts and clays that are not conducive to the plume going in that direction. So for this particular time frame, the plume would not be very successful in getting through this area and getting down gradient. Rather, would take a hard left-hand turn and go around the hills. So putting all of these things in context in one single visualization can be very powerful for trying to understand large, complex data sets. And 3D visualization is really valuable in getting us there. Slide 57. It's not just for existing data. As Kara mentioned, she's using it to drive components of the dynamic field investigations at Well 12A. And we can use it for targeting intelligent samples to do things cost-effectively, minimizing our uncertainty. They can help us identify concentration or exposure pathways that we missed, those unknown unknowns that Mr. Rumsfeld told us about. And then sampling density evaluations. We can do things like uncertainty and confidence analysis, sensitivity analysis, to figure out when we have a sufficient data set to make the types of decisions that we need to make at these sites. And then slide 58, I mentioned we may be doing a future webinar highlighting the 3D visualization, but actually being able to show you this in the videos themselves versus the static images, and I hope that's something that we can do in 2012. We're also looking to do some outreach for our Superfund remedial project managers in terms of continued training on the use of these tools, presentations for the sites that we're supporting. We're looking at developing some best practices for quality control, as well as contracting for those same services. So getting our remedial project managers to have some expectation of costs, what they should see for deliverables, and what it takes to transfer a conceptual site model built in one of these platforms, as well as some updates to the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable Decision Support Tool Matrix, which describes the capabilities of some of the tools that we've talked about here today. Some of these tools will end up in that FRTR Decision Support Tool Matrix, and 3D visualization is a big part of that. Finally, slide 59. Just quickly, some summary of benefits of 3D visualization. Certainly, it's going to help us move our older sites to completion. In the case of 12A and Kira's struggles at 12A, it helps illustrate when a system is operational and functional, or what activities we may need to get to the determination of operational and functional, which is a facilitation to state operation and maintenance, is a key component within the Superfund program. And certainly going to help us optimize existing remedies or new designs. So when we take these simple images and we back them by large understandable databases, and we can do things like confidence calculations and integration of those multiple independent data sets, we have a real powerful tool to make a determination of whether or not we're on the right path. And when we have agreement through these multiple lines of evidence, or whether we have divergence, those are indicative of the next steps we need to take for our remediation sites. And with that, I'll put our contact information up and see if Mike says we have some time to answer some questions.
Well, we do, if you guys are willing to stay on. We don't have another seminar scheduled after this. I will make a comment here that the document that Steve talked about the best management practices for project lifecycle conceptual site models. It is available on CLUIN right now, and the easiest way to get there is to go to slide 63 and click additional resources, and it'll take you right to our additional resources pages where we have conveniently posted it for you. If there are any questions from the phone lines, you may now hit #6 to unmute and offer your question.
Yes. Hi, this is Jerry Johnson from Region 9. I have a large mine site that this would be the answer to my prayers. It's 3,200 acres. It's got full source areas, a pit lake, and an off-site groundwater plume that's moved about 2 miles, 3 miles north. I'm just trying to figure out in my head how I would actually affect this at my site. Is this software fairly standard now, so I could ask the responsible parties make this happen, or are we supporting it internally? Do we have software? Do our RPM, or our contractors have the software? How do we make it work?
I'll take a stab at that. Your name again? I'm sorry, I missed it.
Jerry Johnson.
Jerry. Okay. Well, many of the stuff you saw here today in relation to Well 12A was developed both from a tech support contract here at headquarters and also the regional RAC contractor. So many of the large firms and many of your regional contractors probably have 3D visualization capabilities, are probably using something like MVS or Earth Vision. And then, you know, we've also worked on sites where these types of visualizations have been provided to us through responsible parties consultants, and we've been asked to do quality control or quality evaluations of their work products. So the capabilities are certainly there in both Region 9 and around the country. It really depends on who you're getting, who's doing the work, what contractors you might have access to, but there are ways to access additional tech support depending on the program you're in. So if you want to follow up with me, I might be able to help you chase down some leads there. But my guess is that either a contractor that you have has the ability to do some of this stuff, or that the responsible party may have folks who do this as well. Because we've been doing this mostly in support of RPMs.
Okay, thanks.
I guess the one thing I would add to that, Steve, is just from the perspective of an RPM, I think what's really important to highlight is that, you know, these systems are only as good as the input that goes in and the technical people that you have working on it. So QC and having access to someone who understands MVS and how things are maybe being manipulated and things are really key. So, you know, even if I was to have a PRP, if I was going to have a PRP do this for me, I would want to have access to someone on my team that's supporting me that really understands MVS better than I do to help me QC it.
Yeah, that's an important point. Thanks, Kira. We have other questions?
Let's see. Let me read a couple off here that came in online. And one of them is actually a QA-QC question, so let's go with that one. What is the QA-QC process or sensitivity analysis used within the MVS model to determine if the kriging settings used to establish ISO services are the best fit for the given data? Essentially, what is your process to ensure that the kriging settings selected are providing the most accurate interpolation of the data?
I think I'm going to let Jackie take a stab at that one.
Well, there are some, you know, best practices things we can put out, but, you know, there's not a basic, it's for each data set you have to go in and evaluate, you know, your range and distribution. And be sure you're setting, you know, your non-detect values correctly, and then we process it with the highest resolution grid that we can, practical, you know, for the problem. And then you can also go through, we just went through some analysis for, on this Newmark site, on the impact of max gap and varying sampling distributions, you know, vertical distributions, because you have to look at, you have to always take into account, if you have a close horizontal setting of, or lateral setting of samples, and a large vertical separation or variation. So we did develop for one of the sites a way of going in and seeing the impact of that and determining when you would be having overestimation or what's called overshooting. And when that overestimation would taper off and you could begin to be satisfied that your max gap or the way you're parsing your samples is not generating overestimation or overshooting. So if you have a real specific example of where you think there is an issue, because there isn't like a one-size-fits-all answer to that, I'd be happy to address it if you send it to me.
Yeah, unless you're going to chime in online or on the phone, there's not an example given online.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the example that Jackie gave was max gap is something that we were looking at when we had a very large site with a huge data set, some of which were very discrete sampling points and other which were samples collected from large municipal wells, where the software would tend to average that concentration over the entire well screen. And so our sensitivity analysis consisted of changing the max gap value and then looking at what it did to the volume estimates that came out of the visualization. And we looked for the max gap, that the lowest max gap that got us to a point of stabilization where we didn't see large fluctuations in the plume estimate, in the volume estimate. So that was one way of tackling that issue. But as Jackie mentioned, I'm not sure there's any specific thing you can do to ensure you're using the best geostatistical parameters other than to adjust some of those and look at the sensitivity analysis associated with making adjustments to those and how those align with your conceptual site model and what you see at your site.
Yeah, I think you made a good point there with the conceptual site model part of that. You know, within the context, and it's sort of also a check back on whether or not, you know, you really know your conceptual site model that well and where the gaps are. And to get related to that, we had a question: how much data was generated to produce the visualization shown, and how much data do you suggest be collected in order to prepare a 3D visualization?
Well, that we might be able to answer that second question in the very near future, because we're starting to apply these same technologies to smaller brownfield sites with much more lower density data sets. So we may be able to make some generalizations about how much is enough to put in there. But in the case of 12A, we had 20-some-odd years of data, well over 100 logs, so lots of geologic information, lots of hydrogeologic information. And we're at least lucky in the Superfund program to have those sorts of data sets available to us, where typically by the time we get a request to provide help with a conceptual site model, it's because they've been collecting data for so long, but the data is often contradictory or confusing, that they then turn to 3D visualization and improving their conceptual site models to get their arms around the problem. So we're blessed with typically having sufficiently dense data, but we may be able to in the near future make some generalizations about how much is enough for a particular site.
One other thing you can do is once once you've done these time reconstructions, for each plane and for each plane of time, you can come through and determine the confidence for that plume to have predicted the correct values. At given, you have to work within, like, you know, 90%, 85%, 80%, and you, for each of those, you have a certain confidence-bound factor that's dependent on the site, but you can go through this with the stakeholders, you know, and determine what is the confidence you have to have, you know, what is it that you're shooting for, and that tells you, given your current distribution of samples, what's my confidence that I'm predicting, say, plus or minus of 5 parts per billion or 10 parts per billion correctly within that plume. And that'll give you your areas where you need to add density. You need to add density if you want to get to a 95%, or in the case of a remedial design, you'll probably want to be around 95%. And you can dice up your larger sites into smaller components. And especially like at 12A, you may, you know, apply that right within that particular source zone treatment area. That you have to have a certain confidence and then you move forward. But it'll give you where you need to add in those samples and tell you where you are today, because those existing site data would, you know, only have up to maybe 80% or something like that within a certain value range. So you can always go that path too.
Okay, well, as you know, everybody usually comes up with a question about cost, and we did have one. So the question is, you know, given the 20 years of existing data, how much, you know, what's the estimated cost to build the database for this site? Or do we know?
Well, Kira may be able to ballpark that, but my guess is that the efforts that went into doing the 3D visualization were substantially less than the efforts that went into collecting all of that data for 20-some-odd years. There are license requirements for the software that we're using. It's a commercially available software, and I think the actual license to own and operate the full software is, and Jackie can correct me if I'm wrong, but somewhere around $10,000. But the cost of doing the visualization and collecting the information and all of that, in the case of our efforts for 12A, were below $50,000, and I imagine significantly below the cost of all of the sampling and data collection efforts that went on over the 20-some-odd years, and the cost of all the operation of the remediation systems, too. So I'll let Kira chime in. Maybe she'll have some ballpark.
You know, I can't remember off the top of my head, but if the person that had that question wants to email me, I can give you, because I have it pulled out as a separate line item on my scope. But it wasn't over, I would estimate about $50,000 has been put into the actual modeling piece of it itself, into the MDS work.
Okay, and I guess at some point you have to just, I mean, a point has to be made that, in order to make decisions, all this data has to be pulled together anyway. And then that's a significant cost in and of itself, regardless
yeah,
of whether
exactly.
You're going
and
to...
Yeah, exactly. And so that doesn't even account for, like, the time saved with, like, I mean, it's an integral part of the whole planning process, right? So it saves time on other things.
Well, I hate to do this, folks, but it is after 3:15. If we weren't able to get to your questions today, you can email or contact the presenters with your question. Their contact information is on slide 1 and also on slide 60.
Before you check out on us, though, could you please go to slide 63 and click on the feedback form and link and fill out the feedback form for us. We would appreciate any feedback you could provide. And we thank everybody. We thank the presenters for discussing an interesting topic with us today, and we thank you all for participating in today's Clue In Seminar.